chronicles these events in a new memoir called Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident, and he joins us now to talk about them. Welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, let's talk about that statement that started it all. In fact, you know, we have a little clip of that. Let's listen.
Our opponent is someone who sees America as imperfect enough to pal around with terrorists who targeted their own country.
Now, as it turns out, Sarah Palin was talking about you. How did you feel when you first heard that and you realized that what you had sort of feared and your children had feared could be coming down the pike had indeed happened?
Yeah, it did happen, and it happened initially. You played the Sarah Palin clip, which is quite famous, where she talks about palling around, which is incidentally what I wanted to call the book, but my publisher insisted that Public Enemy was a better title.
She might have been right on that.
It's sometimes difficult to remember, but the person who generated that narrative in the first place was Hillary Clinton. And the place where it really exploded into my life was the debate that George Stephanopoulos moderated between Clinton and Obama near the end of the primary season. And the narrative was simple. And the narrative was, here's this charismatic, beautiful, very brilliant guy. We don't know much about him. He's kind of a mystery man. But let's take a look at his friends. And his friends include a black nationalist minister, a Palestinian scholar, and me, a so-called former domestic terrorist, actually a professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago for decades. But nonetheless, that was the focus. And the trick was not only to demonize those three characters, but then to add the traditional American problem, which is guilt by association. And so Clinton began that, and Palin, and it didn't work for her, and Palin and McCain picked it up. But the night, you say, how did it affect me? Well, the night that it came over the television in that ABC debate, I had my graduate students over for dinner and seminar, and we were finishing the seminar, and someone turned on the TV, and just as they did, Stephanopoulos was asking about Jeremiah Wright and then about me. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a surreal scene for me. My students, when my name was mentioned, when Stephanopoulos said, well, what about your friendship with Bill Ayers? My students fell to the floor, several of them, and one looked at me and said, that guy has the same name as you, to which one of my students said, that's because he is the same guy.
Oh,
and
boy.
It got weirder from there. But it was a strange and unprecedented experience for me, for sure.
Now, I know that you haven't disavowed your past with the Weather Underground. You clarified things in the past, but you haven't said, I'm sorry and I regret all of this. On the other hand, you know, you've got this life as a professor at the University of Chicago, and it's a new life. It's one you've had for a while, and the stuff we're talking about and the stuff that came up with Hillary Clinton and with Sarah Palin, it is in your past. How did it feel to have something like that follow you again and still be nipping at your heels after all these years?
Well, you know, I actually think there's a simple explanation. I've never denied, you know, what I did in my life, and I'm neither shy about it, nor have I, you're right, I haven't disavowed it, nor have I been ashamed of it. It is something that was part of my life, and I was a student leader in opposition to the war in Vietnam. I'm very proud of that. When the war in Vietnam couldn't be ended after years and years and years of struggle and the black freedom movement turning against it and vets turning against it, the majority of the American people were against the war, and yet we couldn't stop it. By not stopping the war, every week that it plunged forward, 6,000 people a week were being murdered. And we were desperate to find ways to stop it, those of us who thought ending the war was a critical, you know, kind of principled place to be. So, yes, that all happened. And it's not exactly true that I have no regrets. I mean, that's often said about me, but it's just not true. I'm 68 years old, and everyone has regrets, no matter how old they are. My 9-year-old granddaughter has regrets, but at the same time, what I don't regret is throwing my life and my body and my energy into ending that genocidal war. I'm actually quite pleased with that. But I think that, let me add one other thing. I think there's a reason that we can't get over Vietnam, and the reason is we haven't yet, as a country, come together and told the truth about it. Because we haven't told the truth about it, we still kind of are anguished about it.
Why would you say we haven't told the truth about it? Because I think it's largely acknowledged that it was an unwinnable war. Republicans and Democrats have said that. What is the part that's not true?
Well, I mean, I think that John Kerry came home when he was a young officer from Vietnam in the mid-60s and testified before Congress and said, we commit war crimes in Vietnam every day, not as a matter of choice, but as a matter of policy. That was the truth. That was the unvarnished truth. That's what he said. He's been running away from that statement ever since. But the reason I say that it's still that, for example, that truth is not acknowledged by us. That means that everyone who participated in it should, in either in the war itself or in those times or in opposition to that war, should come forward and tell the truth about what they did. For John McCain to run as a war hero is absurd. My brother was a war hero. He deserted rather than go to Vietnam and fight. To me, that's a heroic thing to do. Bob Kerry, who admittedly killed two elderly Vietnamese in their hut outside of a village to prevent them from crying out a warning, running for the U.S. Senate, governor of Nebraska, I mean, these things are not accounted for. And that's why you can get John McCain or Henry Kissinger still being the wise men of foreign policy. But they haven't accounted for the crimes of that moment. And they're serious crimes.
They are serious crimes. And at the same time, the truth is subjective. You're never going to get everybody to agree on a truth out of Vietnam, including a Vietnam vet like Kerry and someone like you who was fighting on the other side. That's not something.
No, Kerry and I absolutely agreed in the mid-60s. But no, I wouldn't say the truth is simply subjective. What I would say is the truth is a quest. It's a search. It's not an end point. And no, we won't all agree on every fact. But the truth is that, say, take South Africa, which was roiled in conflict for decades and decades. They went through a process where people told the truth. Everybody didn't agree about what the truth was, but people came forward and spoke openly about what they did, how they participated in apartheid or in the anti-apartheid struggle. People who were against apartheid made mistakes and committed crimes and errors as well, and they accounted for that. We've never done anything like that. We still talk about Vietnam. You're right. I mean, there's kind of a consensus in the folks you hang out with that it was a mistake. But even the way you said it, it was a mistake. It was unwinnable. Or another term that's used constantly is it was a quagmire. A quagmire is something you trip into accidentally. You put your foot in the swamp and then it sucks you in. That's not what happened at all. We marched in under the banner of a lie, just as we marched into Iraq under the banner of a lie. And then we committed a pretty serious set of genocidal tactics, including killing over 3 million people. And that's not accounted for. The interesting thing is, I don't know if you've been to Vietnam, but in Vietnam, mm-hmm. they are so over the American war. They've moved beyond it. And that's because they have a shared narrative that has at least the ring of honesty to them. We don't have such a thing.
All right. Well, we'll keep talking with Bill Ayers in just a moment. I'm Veronica Rickert here with Rob Ferret, and we're talking with Bill Ayers, author of Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And Bill, I want to pick up with what happened after your name got out there and your affiliation with Barack Obama, your relationship with him, with which George Stephanopoulos sort of described as friendly. What did you decide to do at that point?
Now, George Stephanopoulos, I think, was quoting David Axelrod saying that we were friendly. And, you know, the truth is that we knew each other around Hyde Park. Hyde Park, Chicago, is a small neighborhood. And when he called me a guy around the neighborhood, which is how he responded, I thought that was just right. I didn't feel patronized in the least. I thought he was a guy around the neighborhood, too, before he was, you know, who he became. We would see each other in the bookstore and the supermarket. We sat on a couple of boards together, nonprofit boards in Chicago that supported community organizing and so on. And we spoke at conferences together, but we weren't like best friends sharing, you know, a milkshake with two straws. We knew each other. He knew thousands of people and like millions of people. I wish I knew him better now. But what happened is, you know, I became kind of this figure in the media, and it was a cartoon character from my point of view. I mean, what the book really details is after the war in Vietnam ended, and interestingly, earlier when we were talking, I think I immediately get bogged down in the Vietnam War once again. I can't kind of stop myself. But the book really details what happened afterwards and, you know, how one tries to live a life, you know, true to the kind of passions and commitments that ignited my activism when I was a young man. How do you do that over a long period of time and in changing circumstances? And so when I looked at the book, I was surprised at how much of it is about teaching and parenting and moving, you know, into the areas that I care about. But as I say, in kind of a different time, but maintaining my kind of activist and radical edge on these things. So the campaign begins. My kids and my wife and my brothers and a lot of other close friends urged me to not participate in the media frenzy about Obama. And everyone felt there was nothing to be gained and everything to be lost, that there was no way to be heard among the, you know, above the din. And so I didn't speak to the media for, you know, between April and November of 2008. I just turned away and I did my own work. I was writing a comic book at the time, and I spent every day sitting at my table working on my comic book. And then it passed by, and when it was over, I felt kind of off the leash, and I began to, you know, talk much more publicly again. And a few years later, decided to write this account of what happened, and that's Public Enemy.
Barack Obama was the second Democrat that you said you voted for in a presidential election. What was it about Obama that convinced you to vote Democratic?
Well, I voted for two Democrats in my adult life, and I had illusions about none of them and neither of them. First was George McGovern when he ran, you know, against the war in Vietnam, and second was Barack Obama when he ran as a young hopeful person who was, you know, against the continual kind of madness of this kind of never-ending war on terror. But when I say I had no illusions, what I mean by that is that all through the campaign, Barack Obama said, I'm a moderate, pragmatic, middle-of-the-road politician. And the right wing looked at him and said, no, he's a secret Muslim socialist who pals around with terrorists and Palestinians. And the left looked at him and said, he says that, but I think he's winking at me. My take, having known him somewhat in his political career and as a guy around the neighborhood, was that he was absolutely accurate. He is a moderate, middle-of-the-road, pragmatic politician. So that's part of my take on him. And I write in the book a lot about how this, how to understand this and how to understand what our responsibility is given that. I think we spend far, far, far too much time, those of us who dream of a world of greater peace, greater joy, greater democracy, and greater justice, I think we spend too much time looking at the sites of power we have no access to, the White House, increasingly the Congress, the Pentagon, and far too little time looking at the sites of power that we have absolute access to, the neighborhood, the community, the street, the classroom, the workplace. And so that's where I tend to do my work. I don't really worry a lot about politicians and what they're going to give us. I worry much more about changing the conversation on the ground so that we can imagine a fairer, more just, more peaceful world and work toward it.
So you're doing your activism now at the local level. And I wonder, though, you know, given your roots with the Weather Underground, known for, you know, radical tactics, targeting political, you know, big political buildings, for instance, like the Pentagon, I wonder if, looking back, you're glad that you have kept a lot of your ideals, and you're still working at activism now, but a lot of the critiques of some of the activists in the Vietnam era was that they're now comfortably ensconced, you know, yuppies living in nice homes, and they don't really care that much about politics or social activism
anymore.
Well,
I care deeply about politics, and I think young people do too, but the reason I care about politics, and it's not quite true to say that I work only on local politics. I work nationally on issues like the defense of public education, which I think is under sustained attack, and like I'm part of the movement trying to end mass incarceration, trying to end the endless war. So I'm very much involved in the activism in Chicago and outside Chicago.
But I guess what I'm getting at is, do you feel that your generation of activists has sold out?
Not really. I mean, I what does it mean to sell out? You know, interestingly, after I wrote Fugitive Days, which was my first memoir about the years of the American War in Vietnam, everyone who interviewed me said, you don't look like weatherman. And I don't know what that means. You know, I'm trying to figure out does one of them look like? And increasingly, I mean, one of the funniest things that happened to me since the 2008 election is whenever I speak on campuses, I am picketed by the Tea Party. And there's a whole section in my book called Talking with the Tea Party. But what happens is after the controversy and after I'm allowed to come, say, to the University of Wyoming, when I come out on stage, I can almost feel the disappointment. They're looking for somebody who has fire coming out of his ears, and here's this old professor hobbling across the stage. Who is that? You know, where's the scary guy? So I think it's amusing. I think it's still the stereotype, but I don't make that comparative claim that you're implying. I think young people today are idealistic, hopeful, activist in many ways, and in Chicago, I could point you to the Immigrant Youth Justice League, for example, or the queer rights organizations around my university, who are fantastic and completely activist, and I think making a difference. I think if you look at the last 4 or 5 years, the people who made progress were the people who made noise. That's always the way it is. You know, that the immigrant youth and the queer movement and the women's movement made progress, whereas the peace movement and the voting rights, we slipped backwards. I think you have to be committed to not only the right ideas, but to mobilizing yourselves and being heard.
And Bill, we've only got about 30 seconds or so left, but I wonder, how do you feel about that next crop of activists coming up that you see at the university and beyond there in Chicago and elsewhere in the country?
Nothing but hope. I end the book in my acknowledgments by saying I've never been more hopeful for the future because of the young people I'm around every day. They are committed. They are clear-headed. They know way more than we knew. And in some ways, the mythology of the 60s is a place of perfect demonstrations and great music and great love affairs. It acts as a wet blanket on young people today. I think we should get over it. The 60s just was what it was. It's prelude to what we need to do now.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Bill Ayers, the author of Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident. And he'll be speaking at the Wisconsin Book Festival tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Capitol Theater in Madison.